From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the series finale of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Larry David's friend Jeff is making a kind of a prank phone call, and he uses a fake name. He introduces himself on the phone as Journey Gunderson. Apparently, Larry David liked the name, thought it'd be fun to play with it during the finale. Jeff and Larry say Journey's name several times. But what viewers might not have known was that they were essentially giving a shout-out to the National Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York. Journey Gunderson, you see, is a real name. It's the name of the executive director of the National Comedy Center. The center opened 6 years ago, and sometimes it's still hard to believe that the National Comedy Center is in Western New York, a short drive from us, with some of the luminaries of comedy sitting on the center's board and visiting often. Maybe you saw comedian Nate Bargatze hosting Saturday Night Live this past weekend. Well, Bargatze serves on the center's board. He's donated the SNL cue cards from one of the famous sketches to the center. And it's been a little while since we checked in with the team from the center, and it feels like the world needs comedy, maybe more than ever. Not that anything's going on in the world, but maybe, just maybe, it's important. Journey Gunderson is here in studio, the executive director of the National Comedy Center. Welcome. It's nice to see you here in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
And Todd Youngman is a stand-up comedian. We see Todd very often, well, really all over the country, even all over Canada, I think.
He even hit Canada. Yep.
But often at Comedy at the Carlson.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about what you've got coming up.
Sure, let's
nice,
do it.
Nice to see you back here. Did you know, Journey Gunderson, that your name was going to be dropped on the series finale of Curb before it happened?
Jeff Garlin had asked me once in person if he could use it as a character name. After he riffed for a couple of minutes, actually at the memorial service of George Shapiro, about what a ridiculous name it was, he and I were both speakers, and he followed me, and he had a lot of fun with it then, and he asked afterward, you know, can I use that sometime? And I said, of course. And I never thought about it again for 2 years until my phone blew up the night of the series finale.
So they didn't warn you. He didn't, like, text you in advance, like, just so you know, it's in there.
Oh, no.
That's even better, right? Yeah. The series finale hits, everyone's watching, and then you're, wow. I mean, you just got to almost fall over dead that they just, and they used your name a lot there. That was very funny.
Oh, yes. I think some people now just call me Gurney Manunderson. Gurney and I'm fine with it. It's, you know, it's an honor.
It went from Journey Gunderson to Gurney Manunderson. No, that's outstanding. And that's, I mean, that's a kind of a wink and a nod and a shout out to the center. You'll take it, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Any publicity is good publicity.
That's right.
Because the National Comedy Center is in Jamestown, New York, of all places. I've got plenty of family there. Journey grew up there on Chautauqua Lake. And so, you know, we're used to it. But for a lot of Rochesterians even, I think there was a surprise, you know, in the last decade when it's like, where is the Comedy Center going? It's like, where? It's in Jamestown. It's in Jamestown, New York. How is it going 6 years in?
It's going really well. All of the kind of intangibles and esoteric things that you can't guarantee in terms of credibility and the comedy community deciding it is the place. Those things are happening and the floodgates have opened in a great way. And no matter what, you know, and I used to say that during the evolution of it and the design phase and raising the money to build it, it's a nonprofit. I said, we could hire the best museum design firms in the world. And if this doesn't have the buy-in of the community and if authenticity isn't paramount, then this thing becomes the butt of a joke really quickly. And I've joked that I used to lie awake at night going, was this a really bad idea to build something formal and institutional for the most irreverent anti-establishment population of people and artists that exists who are really good at making fun of things? And so I sit here today relieved that whether you are an artist like the gentleman sitting next to me or the most ardent cultural critic of museums, or whether you're just a casual consumer of comedy, average American tourist, the reviews are in and people like it. And that is really fulfilling. I'm also really aware that more than ever that there was a serious void of any institution doing this work. There was no cultural institution stepping up to preserve comedy's heritage and its story and its resource-intensive work. And it's important work, and I'm glad that now there's an institution to do it.
In a moment, we're going to listen to a couple of clips that I think show a little bit of how great comedy is still built on a history of great comedy. And it's fun to know some of the roots. I've been to the center one time and I've loved it. Todd, how many for you?
Five.
Five times.
Yeah. It's kind of my church. It really is. I go all the time. I tell people, you don't have to be a comedian to go, but I tell comedians you should go, you know, learn the history of what you're doing. But I tell, you know, just regular civilians, go check this place out. It's absolutely incredible.
Did you at any point experience some of what Journey was describing, like this, well, do we need a center? Like, what is going on here? Or did you immediately think it's about time?
No, the minute I heard about it and once it was opened, I went 2 years after it was open. And I've been, you know, like I said, five times. I make the drive. I love it. I've gone with people, but I was telling Journey earlier that I want to go alone so I can do it at my pace and read it. Because there's things you just want to sit and read, like George Carlin's notes.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much there. And you want to just sit and, you know, examine them and read them. And same with Joan Rivers stuff and Rodney Dangerfield stuff. You can just sit for a while and read this stuff.
I'm very curious to know, listeners, if you have been there. Because a big question early on was like, if you build it, they will come. Will they come? Will they? So I want to just ask you very directly if what you are seeing in terms of tourism flow is what you hoped it would be. Is it meeting the needs to sustain the center? How are things going on the economic side of the ledger?
Great question. We're really excited to say that, you know, after a beginning where it wasn't great to open 19 months before a global pandemic, things are going really well. We've had more than 500,000 visitors in that time period, and consider two of those years at least affected by COVID. It's our proximity to drive market population. You know, we're within 3 hours of Rochester, Cleveland, Toronto, Pittsburgh, Buffalo. And we didn't just throw a flag in the ground and say, we hope this works. This was preceded by years of feasibility analysis that, you know, told us that attractions like this and museums like this, if you start one now, actually don't work in major metro areas like New York City, let's say.
Why is that?
Because there's too much competition in the cultural sphere when people have 2 days in New York City. And in fact, we saw this with the opening and 19 months later closure of the Sports Museum of America in Lower Manhattan. You know, on paper, that sounds like a
no-brainer.
That
was a thing that happened? I don't even
never heard of it.
Yeah, and it opened right in New York City. And you'd think with the population that is just there and then the tourism that it would work. But destination museums and attractions do well. And as Rob Reiner said when he kind of announced with Mel Brooks on the Today Show that it would become the home of Carl Reiner's archives, he said, you know, you have to want to go. It's a destination. But those things work. I mean, look at Cooperstown with baseball.
And so do you feel like you're at kind of a glide level where, you know, everybody wants more. You want more tourists. You want more people in the door, of course. But if you can sustain where you are you okay? Is the center okay?
As long as I keep making the case for the mission and sustaining it with contributed revenue, which we always knew would be part of it. And if you talk to anyone in the nonprofit world, particularly in the museum sector, almost no museum survives purely on the turnstile. And so what I've been really pleased with, for example, is just in the last 2 years, we received a large grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. People are taking note of the work we're doing and recognizing that no one was doing it before. And so we're supplementing the revenue through the door with grant funding in the humanities and arts.
Todd, have you headlined any shows at the center?
No, I haven't.
Is that like, are you inspiring to do this?
I'll tell you, but I've been to headlining shows there. I went to see Kevin Nealon, Rob Schneider, and David Spade. They did a tri-headline show there, which was incredible. But they also have the Tropicana Room, mm-hmm. as it was called, inside the center, which is like, it's a set basically from I Love Lucy, and they do comedy shows there. I'm not hinting that
people
I want to do a show there, but I would love to.
But you're not hinting at it. how many people on, and what's it called? The
Tropicana Room.
Tropicana Room. How many people can
190.
See 190.
So it's an intimate room, and it is a recreation of Ricky Ricardo's famous Manhattan nightclub. And so I should mention, we operate both the National Comedy Center Museum and then down the block, the Lucille Ball Desi Arnaz Museum, because, of course, the origin story is that Lucille Ball was from Jamestown. And it's not just that she was from Jamestown. She said to Jamestown in the late 80s, please don't just celebrate me or put my stuff in glass cases, make my hometown a destination for the celebration of this entire art form and all of the artists, because no one's doing that and no one's ever done it. So it took us a few decades, but now we operate both. And so we have a few rooms in Jamestown, and it's such an important story of comedy, just the story of venues and rooms and the attributes that make them great comedy rooms. Comics love the Tropicana Room because of your intimate proximity to the audience. We also have the Reginald Nye Center for the Arts that seats 1270, and the Northwest Arena, where some of our biggest headliners have performed, and that's 2200.
Before we listen to some clips that I think are going to take us in interesting directions, I also want to just ask you on side of the human scale of this. Are you past the point? Well, I don't know if you, Journey, I don't know you personally, so I don't know if you're the type who, you know, you take on a big role in a big project like this and feel the weight of the responsibility. But, you know, I feel kind of personally connected to Jamestown because of all my family in the area there. And when I heard this thing was going there, I'm like, wow, this is kind of amazing. But I really hope it works. Like, I was nervous that it would fail. Not because it wasn't going to be well run, just because will people find it? Will people make the trip? And can it be sustained? Are you past the point of worrying about that? And did you worry about that? Did you feel a weight of responsibility to the comedy world?
Every single day. And I think it'd be a bigger red flag if I wasn't of the mindset to be worried, both about the product and the museum being worthy of the artists it celebrates, and on the economic side, making sure it's sustainable. Nobody wants to donate Carl Reiner's archives to something that's fly by night. And failure is not an option. And when you ask, am I past the point? In so many ways, yes. But I think we work hard every day to continue to raise funds because there's more mm-hmm. of comedy's story to tell. Like, it's never going to succeed if it's stagnant. We have to update the content, update the storytelling. But most of all, the product is good. If you read the reviews, people have really enjoyed coming away from the experience with a greater respect for the art form. And that was the mission and that was the goal. And so I'm everybody who visits comes away a fan. And that's what you've seen. You know, you mentioned Nate Bargatze on our advisory board, whether it's Jeff Foxworthy, Gabe Iglesias, Nate Bargatze. They come away saying, I want to support this. Jeff Foxworthy was in tears saying, I have to tell you, I didn't think it was going to be that good. And that's because of our geography. We know it. We're in comedy. We know what Jamestown is and what it isn't. But, you know, he left saying somebody built a tribute to what I've dedicated my life to. And that's so meaningful to us. So people jump on board once they get to Jamestown.
That's awesome. Do you have any way of knowing how much you've affected even hotel stays and things like that? Are guests of the center, or just visitors, are they typically coming in on a day drive and going back out, or are they staying?
We see a lot of people come in expecting to spend 1 or 2 hours, again, because of their perception of what might exist in little old Jamestown, New York, and then deciding to stay the night and get a hotel room because 4 hours go by and they're a quarter of the way through the museum, having geeked out on George Carlin's joke notes or enjoyed the immersive experience of Johnny Carson's 30 years hosted by Jimmy Fallon. So whatever it is, people are amazed that you can't consume it all in one day. And so the length of stay, our length of stay exceeds that of most museums. And we have a lot of repeat visitation, but we designed with that in mind. We knew that was key to feasibility and the economic impact you're talking about.
Todd, you're kind of a nerd about this stuff, aren't you?
Very much, yeah.
And do you find that it's nerdy enough there?
Oh, it's very nerdy. If you love comedy, go. Like, the thing I love most is when you walk in, there's a quote by Billy Crystal that says, everybody else has a place, why not us? And it's true. Comedy needed a place, whether it be New York City, L.A., Chicago, or Jamestown, New York. Comedy needs to be respected and have a place. And it's very nerdy. And I'll tell you, I'm going. You should go with me. We're going to go together.
You and I are going together?
Yeah, we're
going
to road trip.
I guess we're going together.
Yeah, you can bring Megan. It's all right. Everybody can go. We'll all go.
Megan Mack, you're going?
Yeah.
Megan Mack is the actual professional in comedy
on
the Connections team.
Yeah.
The Connections team does have a comedy star.
Yeah.
listen, I want to kind of go through some clips that I think are actually pertinent here. We're talking to, you heard Todd Youngman, who is a stand-up comedian, and you see Todd often at Comedy at the Carlson, but among many other places. Journey Gunderson, executive director of the National Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York, is with us. I bet you it's 2 hours and 20 minutes door-to-door here, something like that. About 2:20.
Yep.
Something like that?
Yep.
Okay, it's piece cake. It's really easy. I don't even think it's three. I don't think it's three.
No.
It's two and change.
Bite your tongue. Not
two,
three.
Two and change.
It's basically 2 hours. Get in the car.
You're scaring the people.
Two and change. So you mentioned Nate Bargatze. I said at the top, and I hope I wasn't wrong, did he donated cue cards to you guys?
That's right. From the now famous, one of the most viewed sketches in Saturday Night Live history, Washington's Dream, from his time hosting 1 year ago. And we have those cue cards now at the center.
So the cue cards you have are from the original. Is that right? It's a sketch that if listeners haven't heard it, I'd be surprised, or haven't seen it, I'd be surprised. But if you haven't, it's great stuff. And he was back on SNL this past weekend, and they reprised it, which I thought was great because it can never be as good as the original because of the surprise of the original. But it's still so good and so absurd. But the concept is Nate Bargatze is playing Washington. Now they are crossing the Delaware. His men are worried about the future of this this young country, and he's talking about ridiculous things that if they can just form their own country, that they can do. And I want to listen to one of the clips from that sketch this past weekend on SNL.
We will live through the battle ahead because we fight to control our own destiny.
Yeah.
To create our own nation.
Well said.
And to do our own thing with the English language.
Our own thing, sir?
Yes. I dream that one day our great nation will have a word for the number 12. We shall call it a dozen.
And what other numbers will we have a word for?
None. Only 12 shall have its own word because we are free men. And we will be free to spell some words two different ways.
Which words, sir?
Donut. And the name Jeff.
What are the two ways to spell Jeff, sir?
It's the short way with a J and the stupid way with a G.
So that's just an example of what I think a lot of people could have done that sketch. Nate Bargatze was the right one to do that sketch. He probably had some influence on some of the tone. What do you think there, Tim?
Oh, it's all in the delivery with that whole bit. It's how he talks. It's his delivery. That's what makes him so special. You know, it's that monotone delivery, and people eat it up. And it worked perfectly for that.
Maybe those cue cards are coming your way to the center, the sequel. What do you think?
Well, there's a lot of comedy story to tell. And as I was just talking with Todd about, you know, we've got 65,000 typewritten jokes of Joan Rivers to put on display next year in her famous card catalog.
How many?
65,000?
65,000.
Yeah.
Yes. It's a joke file that, if you ever saw the documentary on Joan Rivers, it spans the 1950s through 2014, and it's every joke she ever wrote, typed out on a card in a file catalog, and they are categorized and cross-referenced.
How great is that? Like, some people get excited to see the Statue of David. This is my Statue of David.
This is
I would love to see that.
This is it. This is it. But when I hear Bargatze's sketches, Washington crossing the Delaware there, it brings to mind a different bit that is decades old now. And I want to listen to a clip of this. This is from the comedian Gallagher talking about the English language. Let's listen.
Now, P-O-E-M, poem, H-O-E-M, home. No, home is H-O with an M with an E. H-O-M-E, home, S-O-M-E, some. No, that's some. S-O-M-E, some. N-O-M-E, numb. No, that's N-U-M-B. The whole doggone thing is dumb.
It's Gallagher talking about why he was a terrible student and how hard it was to learn the rules of English, which apparently have no rules. And to me, there's an echo there in what Bargatze's doing and what the SNL team is doing with language, with A Dozen, with Jeff, with the silly things that they are riffing on there. And I don't think it's a ripoff at all. I think it's kind of intentional or not. I think there's always little homages to what has come before. What do you think there, Todd?
Oh, absolutely. And even before Gallagher's bit, you had George Carlin doing, give me a second, I think you park in a driveway and you drive on a parkway.
On a parkway. Yeah. Yeah.
Classic bit, great bit. And, you know, there's tons of comedians who do that, you know. I guess, is it double entendre? I'm not even sure if that's what it is.
Yeah, I'm observing the absurdities
of
language.
The language. Yeah. Was a master of it, George.
I would tell listeners, look up the whole Gallagher catalog on language. I just love what he does there with that. And then sometimes, Todd, you get these controversies where comedians will accuse others of stealing material.
Yeah.
But there's so much material, and there's so much that we are inspired by.
Yeah.
I mean, I've heard both authors and songwriters say that... It's not that they said there's no original material, but they're saying everything is an inspiration that is derived perhaps in bits and pieces elsewhere. So
sure.
What becomes the line of theft and what is like, you know, homage and inspiration?
There's something called parallel thinking. Like you come up with a similar premise of a joke and you deliver it and it will seem like there's a lot of people who do bits about a self-checkout at grocery stores or Target. There's a lot of people with that similar kind of joke. And somebody might say, oh, they stole it from so-and-so, which isn't the case. They're doing it totally different. But it's just a whole, like I said, parallel thought. They're doing, you know, different tags and punches to it.
I mean, there's comedy about relationships, but you can't do it, Todd. It's been done. You can't talk about relationships.
Yeah, right. That's the thing. You should be able to.
Yes,
right?
Exactly right.
But every topic has probably been done.
Well... And then the other observation with Bargatze that I would make is if you saw the SNL episode, there was a separate sketch in which he is in the audience of a Hispanic game show. And it's a very high energy spoken in Spanish game show. And he speaks very little Spanish. And he gets called up on stage and he is not really understanding. And he's kind of a fish out of water.
Yeah.
But because it's Bargatze and because it's 2024, it is... The joke is more on him, and he's not making fun of the culture. In fact, the culture is sort of winking and making fun of him for being the fish out of water. Whereas if you go back 25 years when Chris Farley was in that sketch was about Chris Farley being on vacation in Japan with his wife. He gets called to a Japanese game show, not knowing that if you lose, you have to cut your own fingers off. And it's Chris Farley. I laugh, but it's probably a little bit different in terms of tone as the,
sure.
interacting with the
similar
culture.
Similar premise.
But what I like is, this is a long way of asking you a very kind of straightforward question, which is there's a lot of hand-wringing in the last 10 years about where comedy is going. Like, you can't joke about this. Mm-hmm. Jerry Seinfeld's talked a lot about that. You can't go on college campuses. You can't do this. You can't do that. And for a while, it looked like, well, we're just going to divide into two camps. We're going to have like the political right and the political left, and there's going to be humor for each. And I think we're past that. Like, I think that, like, you can be really funny and just, you know, like, still not be a jerk. By the way, you can be a jerk. That's fine. Go do it. Like,
sure.
You'll have an audience. You'll do fine.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to get canceled. You can do it.
Yep.
But I also think you could do it Bargatze's way, the way they did that sketch, which is like, we're not going to make fun of the culture. We're going to make fun of ourselves here, and it's still going to be funny, and it is still going to be edgy, and it's going to be okay. Like, and it doesn't matter what your politics are. We
right.
can all laugh.
Yeah.
Do you think that's where we are? Do you think we've gotten over a hump with that?
Yes. About 4 years ago, it was the tide went a different way, and now I think it's swinging back where people are – you're seeing a lot more edginess. You know, people are not having a problem saying whatever they want now. Before, you would say it and you get canceled immediately, but it's starting to swing back in that direction.
I mean, I can't believe Family Guy stayed on the air this whole period of time.
Or South Park.
Just like not even worried at all who is offended.
They don't care.
You know, no right. sacred cows. And so I think we're in an interesting point that is a little more complex than that. Well, there's political right and political left, and, you know, the left is sensitive and the right will say anything. I don't think that's where we are.
Yeah.
I think we're in a healthier place.
But comedy's subjective, just like, you know, music, comedy's same thing, you know. You, like Mark Ippolito, who runs the club, his big thing is, you know, before you come see a show, you know, research the comic you're coming
sure,
to see. You know,
sure.
Watch some YouTube videos, see what they're like. Like he always says, you don't go out for a night of music and hope they play jazz, you know, which is a great line, you know. But I did credit him for that. I didn't just steal that.
You did not steal that?
You heard it, right? I credited him.
You credited it, yeah.
So, yeah, it's subjective, and the tide is, I think, it's changing a little bit.
Well, the happy thing, Journey Gunderson, who is the executive director of the National Comedy Center, is there is something for everybody. I'm not doing this as an ad for the center. I mean, realistically, there's probably all kinds of different ideologies, political approaches, and flavors of comedy. And maybe it's not everything is for everybody, but probably the center understands that. I mean, how do you see that?
That was a key compass in the design approach. Everybody completes a sense of humor profile when they arrive. Because comedy is subjective, and we had produced comedy festivals for 30 years before opening the museum, and we'd seen people walk out of the same show and have two completely different opinions. And so it's true, there's something for everyone. My kids are 9, 7, and 5 and would stay there all day if I let them. There's also a blue room level of the museum, and we didn't just build it because we thought it would be great to glorify the most controversial comedy. We lean into telling the story, because we are the museum of this art form, of what has been controversial and taboo throughout different eras in our history. And when it comes to quote-unquote cancel culture, there has always been cancel culture. One of the biggest exhibits in the Blue Room is it includes the court papers from Lenny Bruce's obscenity trials in L.A. and New York, and he refused to censor himself, and his career suffered, you know, horribly for it. And the Smothers Brothers, you know, were fired. They weren't canceled. Their show was great and doing well, but they were fired because they were butting heads with CBS, the titan of entertainment at the time, when there are only so many channels. And now you can really, you have more, I would say you have more freedom. What has changed is the room. The audience reaction didn't used to get printed. Now it does on the internet. When people freak out in reaction to something.
That's so interesting. That's such a good point.
It's written. And it doesn't go away, and it stays there. And so it can pick up steam and momentum, and it can lead to a greater controversy. So our quote-unquote rooms have changed, because it didn't just die that night in a live performance or on a live broadcast. It's there for consumption over coffee in the water cooler Monday morning and for everybody to opine on.
That is, I mean, it's a very, very powerful point about how modern media and platforms have changed a little changed a lot of the dynamic. I do think this is a very optimistic take for me, because I'm very pessimistic on a lot of social media. I think whatever's happened to X is just ugly and awful, and I'm barely on it and trying to pull myself off it entirely. It's like quitting smoking. Mm-hmm. Like, why am I doing this? It's so bad for me. I just thought of a Mitch Hedberg line. You know, people say, you know how hard it is to quit smoking? Yes, it's just as hard as it is to start flossing. It's a great line. It's a Mitch Hedberg line. But all of which is to say, I don't like the platforms. But I think that with any new thing, there's different ways of using it. And I think we are getting past the immaturity of thinking, I heard something I don't like, cancel them, and then let's get the mob going and let's get somebody run out of town. I think it's more mature than that now. I think that there's still conversations about whether it's comedy, media, conversation, speech that people don't like, but I think there's a recognition that there has to be some kind of grappling with it, as opposed to just how fast can we get it out the door here? How fast can we shame it? And anyway, the big players who ostensibly got canceled are still doing fine. Louis C.K. is out there doing fine, and Dave Chappelle, of course, is doing fine, and they're okay. They're okay.
They're going to make it.
Yeah, I think we're in a better place than where I feared we were going 5 years ago. I want to take our only break of the hour, and then I've got a separate clip I want to play that we're going to have more fun with here. I'm going to play a clip from a comedian on the other side of this who's one of my favorites that Todd Youngman gets credit for introducing me to. Todd is a stand-up comedian, one of my favorites in local comedy, in any comedy, local comedy. What is that? Journey Gunderson is the executive director of the National Comedy Center. She's my favorite National Comedy Center director. And we're going to come right back on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, we are joined by presidential historian Timothy Naftali, who is in Rochester to talk about the politics of foreign policy in an age of extremes. In our second hour, a growing body of research shows a pregnant woman's mental health can affect fetal and child development. We'll talk about the kind of care available. Talk with you Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Really glad that Journey Gunderson has made the trip up from Jamestown. The executive director of the National Comedy Center is with us in studio this hour, talking about how things are going at this cultural institution that 6 years ago opened in Western New York, is doing very well. Todd Youngman has been there 5 times. He is a stand-up comedian who is with us in studio. And we're talking about the state of comedy, how the center is doing, and really it's sort of the vital nature of comedy. I know it's so cliche, like now more than ever, but like, yeah, like, but like definitely now more than ever. Like, sorry if it's cliche. Like, I think it's true. And I mentioned we were going to play a clip here. I want to play a clip from one of my favorite comedians, Todd Youngman. A little while back told me, you gotta listen to Gary Gulman. And the reason I want to play this clip is Todd told me, I said, I love Bargatze because he doesn't do a ton of politics. He really turns the arrows at himself. He's self-deprecating. It doesn't feel like you have to feel tense about politics. And he said, well, you got to try Gary Gulman. Well, Gary Gulman does a little bit of politics, a little bit of social commentary. And he, to my surprise, did do a little riff on Donald Trump. I don't think you can do a lot that's funny with Trump anymore. But Gary Gulman, this is him talking about billionaires and how they compare themselves to each other, and this is him on Trump.
I really thought Donald Trump was the richest billionaire. No. He doesn't have $59 billion. And neither will you. Unless this is what you would have to do, other than working really hard and inventing something that takes over the world. The other way to do it is, of course, to win the lottery. You would have to win a $100 million Mega Millions jackpot every week for 600 consecutive weeks. But I'm going to warn you, that type of streak, very rare. Almost unheard of. It's very... But that's what that man is worth, $59 billion. And Donald Trump, on the other hand, he's worth, this is great, $2.9 billion. Oh, what a loser. What a loser. $2.9 billion. That's less than five. You round down less than five. Essentially, he's worth, in my calculations, he's worth $0 billion. He's worth $0 billion. And yet he's, well, you're fired, you're fired. You're broke. Shame on you. You should be embarrassed.
So that's Gary Gulman. Just one clip from one of my favorite comedians there. Why did you recommend him to me? Why do you think he's great?
Because Gary's cerebral, and I feel you are too.
Oh,
you wrote a book about wine.
Okay, I mean,
that's cerebral.
I don't know.
Or pretentious, one or the other.
Definitely pretentious.
Definitely. But Gary's very cerebral.
And I just had a ton of time.
Yeah.
Really, it was mostly just
and
like...
And you love wine.
Yeah, but I was just like, this. I just have a lot of time.
Journey didn't know this about you, did you? You didn't, no. But yeah, he's very cerebral.
He is. And Todd, the first clip Todd sent me, listeners, if you haven't dipped into the Gary Gulman well... His bit on state abbreviations is absurd and wonderful.
Yeah,
and that's what pulled me in. But when I saw him at Comedy at the Carlson, it's one of the best shows I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It was like 90 minutes of just absolute, like I was in pain.
Yeah,
how good but it was so smart.
Yeah.
It was also a little more political than I thought it was going to be.
And guess what?
What's that?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
You got to be careful.
Yeah, I know. He's coming.
Yeah,
he'll be back.
No, you can say it.
Yeah, he's coming back.
He's coming back.
February 28th, March 1st. CarlsonComedy.com. Grab your tickets.
He's going back to Comedy at the Carlson. He did more on the social and political side than I expected. He was really tough on Jerry Seinfeld in that show.
That was great.
Like, I think he legitimately is not a big fan of the person of Jerry Seinfeld.
I don't think so. Never talked to him about it, but it came off that way.
It came off as like,
sure,
he's not really joking here. Like, he's really hammering Jerry Seinfeld for like having an entire garage full of wealthy automobiles when people are suffering in New York City. So there was that. And I played the Trump clip because, in my opinion, like, as a listener, if you're going to do something on Trump, it better be really good because it's been so done and played out. How do you feel about Trump humor?
I think it's played out. I'm not a fan of any kind of presidential humor, and I know it's, you know, part of the thing and people do it. In my opinion, Saturday Night Live, they beat it into the ground no matter who's in the office. They just beat it into the ground, and it gets to be a little too much. It's not my thing, political humor. I like to go up on stage, do everyday kind of life things, and try not to divide a room as best as I can, and that will do it, politics.
Yeah, certainly will. But even in Gulman's, the clip that I just played here, there is a little bit of social commentary there. He's riffing on how absurd it is, how much money a very small number of people have. So that there's commentary there. The idea that someone with $2.9 billion might be embarrassed that they don't have $59 billion, which, by the way, talk about, if you want to joke about anything about Trump that is actually kind of raw and visceral and real, he is very competitive and he is very insecure, and that's kind of funny. So, you know, kudos to Gary for finding that. But I liked it. To me, like, that's a bit about Trump that I'm like, well, okay, that's
it's
fresh.
Great.
I can do that.
Because he delivers in a Gary fashion, this cocky, smarmy delivery with the laugh when he laughs because he's, you know, he has, what, $2.8 billion?
Yeah.
Like, that's Gary. That's what made it funny. He softened the bit. You know, it didn't keep digging in.
I feel like I just want everybody to see the 90 minutes I saw at Comedy at the Carlson. I can't wait to see him again. He's so good. Has he been to Jamestown? He needs to go to Jamestown. He needs to go to the National Comedy
No, he has
Center.
Not been. I've seen him live several times and have met him. And as you were describing his comedy, it made me think about one of the things we say about why comedy matters, or even what you were just describing. Gary Gulman is playing the role of the court jester. Right. So these are the truth tellers, and they're holding up the mirror to society, and they're poking fun at the king, and they're representing the mood in the room about the events of the time. Several of the bits in Gary Gulman's recent work have to do with growing up socioeconomically disadvantaged.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the other things we talk about with comedy when we look at its history is that one need not come from a position of privilege to step into the shoes of a comedian. So it's an attractive proposition for underdogs. And a lot of what's in our comedy consciousness today was born out of the vaudeville era, where there was this need to populate thousands of stages. And so the people who made it onto the stages were working class and immigrant populations. And therefore, their viewpoints, their realities, their authentic experiences came to color entertainment and the golden age of radio, the golden age of television. And it's one of my favorite things about comedy when we reflect on why it matters as an art form is that it's accessible to get into and it becomes the voice of the people.
You made me think of George Carlin when you said Gary grew up socioeconomically disadvantaged. I think George Carlin would just say he grew up poor.
Yeah.
He did whole riffs on how we soften language, PTSD.
Oh, yes. You know,
shell shock. And I was thinking of all people, the effect, the power of that comedy that was decades ago now. I was thinking of George Carlin when I watched the vice presidential debate. And J.D. Vance said, you know, we're not talking about an abortion ban. We're talking about an abortion minimum national standard. Minimum national standard. 3 words, 8 syllables. Ban, 1 word, 1 syllable. Same thing. So George Carlin would have skewered J.D. Vance for that.
You really know your bits. You do.
On some things, I'm a mile wide and an inch deep. On a few bits, I'm like very narrow but a little deeper.
Okay.
I don't have.
You say so.
No,
you've quoted a lot of things unless you just had research.
Well, I also do a little bit of homework before
of course
the
you
shows
do.
Here.
Yeah.
You know, I know who's coming.
All right.
Journey Gunderson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Todd Youngman.
Gurney McNunderson is on the program today.
I'll take it.
I wish we had that clip. Listeners, if you're wondering, like, I just tuned in, why are you making fun of her name? Because Curb Your Enthusiasm's finale invoked Gurney Gunderson's name on the show. Jeff and Larry used Gurney's name when they were looking for a pseudonym on a prank phone call. So apparently they had fun with the name Gurney Gunderson, but the National Comedy Center will take any of that publicity. And Curb Your Enthusiasm is a show that did okay.
It had a good run.
It had a decent run. Not bad.
And they stuck the landing.
They stuck the landing.
It will be remembered, I think, as one of the shows that nailed the series finale, which is such a difficult
thing to do.
It was good.
And you love how it's kind of meta, where it's absolutely referencing the Seinfeld finale.
Yep.
And I love how, you know, for whatever reason, that was by some people's measures ill-received or didn't think it lived up to the series.
Only because it was bad.
Yeah, and Larry David was kind of like, I'm going to do it again. Because that's his attitude and his tone
but
toward
that,
everyone.
That next layer of it made it, I think, work, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the most successful comedies of all time.
But do you think the Seinfeld finale was a dud? Come on.
No, I don't. I mean, I think I appreciate so much of what's being done by comedians that I tend to be kind of a good audience for things. I just have so much respect for how hard it is. Todd and I were talking on the way in about how good comedy looks easy, and that's probably why it's never gotten the same level of respect, which is funny because that invokes memories of Rodney Dangerfield, of course, talking about respect. But in the National Comedy Center, one of the things that makes people's jaws drop is seeing Dangerfield's joke notes, because a lot of casual consumers of comedy would think he's just winging it and comedians are just these funny people on stage. And they are amazed at the level of precision and honing and detail crammed into every little sheet of paper he carried in his briefcase. And so that really is what we aim to do with a lot of the exhibits.
Talking to Journey Gunderson about what's happening at the National Center, anything you want to mention, by the way, that is coming up for listeners who have maybe never made that trip and are thinking about going to Jamestown to see the center?
Well, if you've been before, you know that you can never really consume it all. I mean, there are people on our staff who have yet to really consume all the content and all of the exhibits. So you can visit dozens of times without seeing everything. And yet there are new things. I mentioned the Johnny Carson immersive experience. We now have an exhibit on the 70 years of Carl Reiner's career in comedy. So what's interesting about that is that he was one of the greatest collaborators. Not all comedians are collaborators. A lot of them are kind of really in their own, you know, they have their own voice and they're kind of singular in their art. Reiner made everyone around him better. And that's one of my favorite things about this exhibit. So you're seeing his lifelong collaboration with Mel Brooks, his directorial role with Steve Martin, the history of things like Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, which was really the preeminent sketch comedy show. We're talking so much about SNL 50, but we should remember that before all of that, there was Laugh-In and Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows. So whether it was Dick Van Dyke or Mary Tyler Moore or Steve Martin or Mel Brooks, the Carl Reiner story of comedy, you know, it's touched everything we kind of consume today.
That's an interesting point about some people lifting others up around mm-hmm. them and others being sort of singular geniuses or singular talents. Todd, do you feel like you can share comedy writing duties with somebody and create a product? Or do you feel like your voice is your voice and it's hard?
I think
your
voice is your voice.
It's tough, isn't
it?
Yeah.
But there's like Jimmy Walker. Back in the day, he had people write for him. He paid him for jokes. There's been tons of comics throughout history who have done that. You know, have them write jokes and pay him a little bit of money. Like Jimmy Walker had David Letterman on his staff, Byron Allen, Gary Shandling at one point. He had tons of people that would write jokes for him. So I personally think it's more of a personal thing to, you know, write from your voice.
Who have you not had at the center that you want, besides Gary Goldman? Who do you want to show up at the center?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm so...
Because you've had so many that have, that are immersed already in what you're doing.
Tina Fey. You know, Amy Poehler is on our advisory board and spent days there, actually on two or three separate trips because she was directing the documentary Lucy and Desi and leaned heavily on our archives. And so I think it would just be great to now get Tina through the doors, but... I'm really pleased with how many people have already seen it and loved it, whether it's John Mulaney or Tom Segura, Taylor Tomlinson, you know, we mentioned Nate, Gabe Iglesias, the list goes on. And there's nothing more fulfilling than seeing how moved artists are. Taylor Tomlinson, when she was in the Johnny Carson exhibit, I didn't know, because it wasn't public yet, that she was about to become the host of a late night show. But in hindsight, you know, the announcement was weeks away. So that probably meant a lot more to her in that moment than I realized what was going on.
I want to ask you a little bit about someone like Taylor Tomlinson, who's kind of blown up in the, I mean, she's been successful for a decade, maybe.
She started when she was 15 or 16.
Yeah, so yeah. She's done really well.
Yeah.
But now she's got a show. I'm seeing her everywhere.
Yes.
And what she talks about sometimes is just being willing to take every show for a long time and just work,
mm-hmm.
and go to every room and get in front of every audience and just keep going and working. And it's got to be exhausting. Or do you find, like, when you get on stage, do you feel like, no, this audience has not seen me and I'm here for them and I'm ready? Do you burn out?
I think you do burn out after a little while. This past weekend, we had Jessica Kirsten at Comedy at the Carlson. And she literally named her tour the Never Ending Tour because she's been on tour for over a year now, just in maybe a couple weeks of breaks. That's it. But nonstop. And you wonder, are you starting to burn out? Is it, you know, does it get old? Do you want to get off the road? It's got to wear on you, you know?
Have you ever gotten in front of an audience and you're like, I can't do it? Because you always look like you're the happiest you can be when you're on stage.
Yeah. Sometimes, you know, depending on what's going on in your life, you have to go up and turn it on, you know, and pretend like there's not, you know, horrible things
happening.
I've
never hosted an episode of Connections where I was just burned out. And
yeah.
Every 2 hours, it's the best.
Do you ever feel like you don't want to do it?
Never.
How about right now?
This is the only time.
Okay. See what we did?
There's a story of Larry David, I think, in The Village.
Did I do that correctly? Was that the right answer, by the way, then? Was that good?
That was really good.
That was good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Larry David took the stage and supposedly took one look at the audience and just went, no. And walked off. Like, uh-uh.
That's so good.
But that takes some power to be able to do that. I mean, really. That's...
And there are some old archival clips of him in The Village in, like, I think the 70s. But
So good. That's so good. Well, it's possible that eventually you're going to see Todd at the center in the Tropicana.
Well, who knows? But I'll definitely be at the center.
Maybe a bigger stage.
Maybe even bigger stage.
Maybe one day.
You know? What are you working on now?
Right now, I'm doing a tri-headlining show with two other friends of mine on November 8th at the Carlson. We're doing it in the Rickles Room. A friend of mine from Albany, Dan Guerin, Liz Reeves out of Buffalo, and my friend Tommy Bechtold is going to be hosting it. So that's November 8th. Come on out, have some laughs. We all need to laugh.
November 8th?
Yeah.
It's like 3 days after the election.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
That's gonna be,
everybody
that's
needs
gonna
be to laugh.
That's going to be a really funny time.
Right.
That's probably going to be really...
It's amazing how an election year brings us all together in peace and harmony. Isn't it great?
Once in a while I see Todd's like Facebook posts, and really, you're like the daily reminder that... Well, I'm just going to say that. Like, nobody changes their mind because you ranted on Facebook about it.
No. Nobody does. I love... It's the funniest... That's my favorite TV show, is watching people argue politics on Facebook. It makes it all worth it.
That's the best.
Yeah.
Now, Todd does great work, and I'm sure that you will be an antidote to people's feelings, whatever is going on November 8th.
I hope so.
So that'll be fun. Yeah. I went back to the 1990s recently because I'm a Gen X guy, and I saw Toad the Wet Sprocket and Bare Naked Ladies, and I'd listened to Ed Robertson from BNL say that, you know, the one thing that they know they can give the crowd is they know that they're going to give the crowd an electric show wherever they've been doing it for 35 years. And he's like, that's our calling card. It's like, you're not going to get us fatigued. You're not going to get us not wanting to be there. This is what we do. And they were great. I did not know until afterwards, when I was listening to an interview with Glenn Phillips, that Toad the Wet Sprocket is a band name that originally came from Monty Python, a deep cut on a 1980 Monty Python release in which they were riffing on like an agent in the music industry who is all hoity-toity. Mm. And he is talking about all of the demands of his up-and-coming band. And they chose the name Toad the Wet Sprocket just to choose the dumbest possible name.
Yeah.
And in 1986, the guys from Toad the Wet Sprocket thought it'd be funny. And they went on, they used it for a gig. They kept using it. And eventually, one of the guys, Palin maybe, was driving down the road and he heard a Toad the Wet Sprocket song and he had never heard the band.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh my God, they use our name from a deep cut. Back when there were comedy albums.
Yeah.
That's a whole other separate show.
Yeah.
I want to thank our guests for making time here. Journey Gunderson, can I give you 30 seconds just to tell listeners who have never been to Jamestown, New York, why beautiful Jamestown is the place to go at any time of year?
Because what sounds more fun than spending hours in a museum that really is is a great curation of comedy's greatest hits. You know, all the best stuff in our history is there, and it's really interactive and fun, regardless of your taste or your age. And I can't think of a better way to spend a few days. And it's a national attraction in your backyard. We were joking about it being 2 hours and change away. We had visitors from all 50 states within 3 weeks of opening, you know, in 27 countries within the first year. This has been named one of the top 25 family weekend getaways in the country on a list with Disney World and Disneyland. So it's in your backyard and it's a national attraction. And whether you're a casual consumer of comedy or an artist, you're going
to
love it.
Take the kids. You still have to take them to the Blue Room if you don't want.
Yeah. That's right.
But let me also say, as someone with that, with all those ties to Jamestown, as someone who rooted for it, it was really cool to go there and be like, oh my gosh, it's so good. And that's just, it's a lot of fun. So congratulations on that. Let's make this a semi-regular check-in to see how things are going there. It's really lovely to talk to you, and it's really fun. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
Journey Gunderson's the executive director of the National Comedy Center. Todd Youngman, I always love this too.
I do too.
You're not on the show enough.
No, I know.
Do you want to host when I'm gone?
I would love to.
You probably should.
Would you let me?
Yes. How about tomorrow? What are you doing
tomorrow? You got a bad day coming.
You
weren't even serious. I would do it.
You would do it?
Right.
Todd's going, don't write a check. You can't cash.
Yeah, I'd do it.
I think Megan Mack, what do you think here?
Megan.
Let's put Todd on the list. Thank you. Great
thank
to see
you. Thank you. Yeah, appreciate it.
Really fun. And you can see Todd at November 8th.
November 8th.
Comedy at the Carlson. Yep. But Todd's there a lot because he loves it there. He does great work there. And
I love comedy.
He loves comedy. Yeah. He genuinely loves comedy. He's a nerd.
I am.
From the whole team at Connections, thank you for listening. Hope you had a few laughs this hour. And we'll be back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.